Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Hello, you tune into the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. As usual, my name is Kingsley Kipuri, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined by my comrade, my partner in crime, Greg Nicholson. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me once again.
I'm good. I like how you always thank me for having you on.
Even though I'm here every week.
You were raised so well, man. I think you just come from a good home.
I just have to be grateful every time I appear on the show because I know it could end soon. Dude, I just say one dumb thing and I'm out of here.
It's a tough economy, man. You know, anything could happen. Dude.
That's right, actually. That is not the topic of today's show.
But on the bright side, you could just be like, it's BEE that made you lose your job.
If I get fired, okay. I'm gonna revert straight to that. Everybody else does, so
just,
why not?
Just keep it in your back pocket. I feel like there's more there. I feel like I'm lacking on the jokes lately. I need to polish up.
If you have any jokes for Kingsley for next week, just tweet him at Mzanzi Masai.
There we go. On the topic of Twitter, please tweet us on at DMShowZA. It's always wonderful engaging with you and seeing the Twitter account continue to grow. It's you know, in the era of social media, my self-esteem is very closely tied to our follower account. Remember, you can also call us on 0861-555-189. Always wonderful hearing from you. We're going to jump right in on something that was really making headlines over the weekend. And that was the issue of what's going on in Tshwane. So this is a key metropolitan municipality that in the run up to the local elections, a lot of people have been watching. And the conversation had been whether the ANC can retain this and whether them losing it would be a sign of a weakening party. And then suddenly we started seeing a lot of violence. One person was shot over the weekend and killed. So the fatal injury. And we saw burning of property, burning of buses. I think 20 buses from one company were burnt over the weekend. So it seemed like a situation that's been escalating. The reports coming out of there is that it's linked to the ANC party list process and the question of who's going to be put forward as the candidate mayor. Greg, I know you wrote on this. It's something you've been following pretty closely. Could you just give us some context on what's going on?
So I think the sort of starting point to note is that the Tshwane ANC is extremely divided by factions. A lot of people have noted over the years that this is what people sort of suggest, and this is one of the problems with this issue, is there's a faction sort of linked to the current executive mayor, Siphutla Ramakgopa, and another one linked to his deputy in the Tshwane ANC, Mapitsi Matsena. And going into these with the candidate lists and the proposals for the mayoral lists from the Tshwane region, the current mayor Siphutla was not named in one of those proposals in sort of lists of the three candidates that the region gave to the Gauteng ANC. But Mapitsi Matsena was. Now, when these three names suggested by the Tshwane region who they wanted to be mayor went to the Gauteng ANC PEC, the ANC PEC rejected them, or they said they weren't happy with any of those options. But they nevertheless took the names to the ANC committee that was looking at the special NEC meeting that was looking at choosing the mayors. Mm. And that meeting of ANC leaders agreed that none of these three names would essentially be viable to put forward as to be the next mayor of Tshwane. And so effectively what they did is they then decided, and I think Deputy Secretary General Jessie Duarte yesterday was quite diplomatic, but she still acknowledged that those three names and choosing some between the different candidates for mayor from these different Tshwane factions would essentially lead to further disunity and considering over this year there've been a number of protests and there have been in the Tshwane region over ANC disagreements over candidates and also over all sorts of little disagreements. It also always sort of pops up in the news here and there that, you know, an ANC meeting was stormed by angry members or some officials have been attacked. I think considering that the sort of history of protest, disgruntlement and even violence, what I think the ANC leaders were saying was that if any of these local candidates were chosen, it just would have led to worse violence. And so essentially you know, what some people say parachuted in a candidate, but what they did is they chose the ANC MP and also former minister, a very, very accomplished politician, Toko Didiza. If the ANC wins, she'll be leaving the National Assembly and going to serve as mayor in Tswane. And obviously the news since then, as soon as it was being discussed on Sunday night, someone was shot outside the area where this was being discussed, shot and killed. And then obviously everybody knows that particularly in Mamelodi and Attridgeville, people have been violently protesting. Mm. They've shut down the communities. Mm. They've burned buses, looted stores in the last couple of days since this has been announced. So I think the question everybody is asking themselves now is, was it the right decision to choose someone outside of these lists suggested by the Tswane region? Or despite the violence, could it have been worse if they had have chosen someone from one of these local factions?
I mean, I hear you. I mean, it sounds, when you look at it sort of in theory and sort of a distance from the situation, it sounds like it makes sense, right? You've got two factions. It sounds like it's just sort of infighting, and it's saying, okay, we don't want to be a part of the factionalism. We don't want to succumb to this violence. So we're going to pick a neutral person.
And a very qualified
in
person.
In theory, a neutral, very qualified senior person that we can all agree on. So in theory, you're sitting there, you're like, yeah, this makes sense.
One of the outcomes is that no one in the region is happy. So everybody gets angry. rather than pissing off one faction, both could be pissed off now. But like, I think there are a lot of details that still have to come out about these protests. I think at the moment, seems like the reporters on the ground have been, number one, focusing on the violence, number two, have faced threats of intimidation, and it seems sort of difficult to really put their finger on just who and what is behind this.
I mean, I hear you. I mean, I think there's sort of other questions around. One is how much... what's the word, responsibility the ANC will take for being sort of at the center of the violence. Will they say, hey, we made a bad call and that's why this happened? Or will they do what we've seen sometimes, not only in Tswane, in different provinces, these accusations about other people and outside forces being behind some of the looting?
I think that their first strategy is to get the leaders of the Tswane region to unite behind Toko Didiza, and they're doing that at the moment to hopefully quell, if they have angry supporters, to quell their unrest. I think they're going to stick to their guns with the candidate. But we'll see how bad things get in Tswane. If things get a lot worse, they might have to reconsider their position. I think also one of the questions that two things I think we have to ask of the ANC is, what did they do, perhaps? Did they do enough as this factionalism and disunity was festering over the years? Did they do enough to sort of quell that? Or perhaps did they even inflame the issue of factionalism in the region? And second, did they consult enough for long enough people and for a long enough time about putting forward the Toko Didiza as the mayoral candidate? Because it was on Saturday night when they released all of their mayoral candidates' names, except for Tswane. On Sunday, they met the Tswane, the region, and took forward this name of Toko Didiza. And then obviously it was just even outside that meeting, someone got shot and killed. So perhaps would it have been beneficial to actually going to longer discussions with the region rather than jump into this potentially prematurely.
I mean, I hear you. And like you said, the situation is still unfolding, so we're really just getting news really by the minute. So people following Twitter, I suppose not SABC for your news source, but people following Twitter and Eyewitness News and so on, there's literally just by the minute updates on that. If you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Kloof Central. Just after 1 p.m., we're just discussing briefly the issue of Tswane and the municipal elections coming up and what's going on. We continue to see violence. Is this really just a symptom of a vibrant democracy? I suppose we'll find out. Next, we want to talk about something called the Enough Project. So the Enough Project is basically an initiative to return stolen assets from Africa, and this in particular is on South Sudan, of saying, listen, we constantly hear about dictators and sort of single party leaders and presidents for life in different countries, and they loot their countries, right? So they run the treasury like it's their personal sort of bank account, and a lot of that money goes offshore and it's taken to America, to Europe, and just different places, with the idea that even if they are out of power, they've pretty much got a sort of a bank account for life, and making sure that they retain that personal wealth should anybody else take over. On this issue of this Enough Project, we'll be talking to Brian Adeba. Brian, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
There we go.
Hi.
Brian, I've given a very, very rough description of the Enough Project. We'd like to hear from you directly. Could you give us some detail on what the Enough Project is and how it came about?
Yeah, the Enough Project, basically, you've captured the definition quite well in general terms. It's basically to, you know, work against impunity and to thwart dictatorships and ensure that, you know, there's accountability for leaders who commit mass atrocities.
Now, Brian, today we're going to be speaking particularly about South Sudan. And while President Salva Kiir has called for the recovery of stolen assets invested in foreign accounts and properties, one of the things I'm interested in is, first of all, the position in South Sudan. I think it's the Enough Project that has written that grand corruption and extreme violence are not aberrations. They are the system. Can you tell us what has happened? How has this situation manifested itself in South Sudan where extreme corruption linked to violence has become the norm?
Well, in South Sudan, what's happened is the system that the SPLM, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, created, basically hijacked all institutions of governance and ensured that these institutions were working for the for a small clique of of the political elite. So, in essence, accountability measures were stymied, and institutions like the Anti-Corruption Commission only exist in name. The National Audit Chamber can issue reports about gross misappropriation of public funds, but no action is taken. And the same officials who have been pointed or fingered for mass appropriation of public funds get recycled in the system. They come to power. When there's a reshuffle in the government, you see them as ministers and so forth and so forth. This is how it manifests itself in South Sudan. So literally, all agencies in South Sudan, all government agencies are working for a small minority, a clique in government, and there's no accountability. And that's as a result, the public monies in South Sudan have just disappeared into thin air, looted, transferred abroad, invested in assets and stored abroad. Basically, that's what's happening.
Are there any estimates of the billions, millions or billions that might be invested abroad and where this money goes? Did you know what actually happens to it?
Well, we do have a figure. The president himself said in 2012 that an estimated $4 billion has disappeared, you know, stolen by about 75 high-level government officials. He did not, however, mention any names publicly. He just said there's been money that's been stolen, and this is the amount, $4 billion, and 75 government officials, high-level government officials, are responsible for this theft, but he doesn't mention their name. So when you accuse someone of a crime, the next thing that people want to see is a name attached to that crime, so that, you know, there's accountability. So in essence, you know, mentioning without mentioning the names, the president basically is cutting the responsibility of accountability. Where is this money stored? Mostly, it's stored abroad, in neighboring countries. Kenya is one good example where there's a lot of South Sudanese money stored in the banking system. There's also property invested in Kenya, as well as in Uganda. Some of this money has also found itself to places like the United States, Australia, and the UK.
Now, it seems the president might be conflicted, because I'd imagine that under his administration, this is where all of this sort of stuff happened. Do you have faith that the president can take action, and what must he do?
Well, right now there is very little faith in the president, in the government's ability to counter corruption in the country. Right now, what must he do? What must the country do? It's very, very clear, and it's been spelled out in the peace agreement that was signed in August 2015. Basically, empower all the government governance institutions so that they effectively carry out their mandate. For instance, take the Anti-Corruption Commission. Right now, there are two pieces of legislation that govern its activities. One is the is enshrined in the Constitution, and the other in the Act itself that operationalizes the Anti-Corruption Commission. Now, the Constitution says that the Anti-Corruption Commission is empowered to prosecute culpable individuals. The Act that governs the Commission's activities does not give that power. So there's this discrepancy. The capacity to investigate and prosecute corruption by the Anti-Corruption Commission is rendered ineffective. The National Audit Chamber issues various statements about misappropriation of public funds, yet no action is taken to hold individuals accountable. So the very first thing that the president and his cabinet and the new government that has been formed needs to do is empower all institutions of governance to effectively carry out their mandate and stymie the massive corruption that is afflicting the country at the moment.
And surely international actors also have a role to play. And this isn't the first instance we've seen of countries trying to claim back what's been sort of looted and stolen and deposited in offshore accounts and invest in offshore properties. We saw in Nigeria, the president there recently also making such claims. What must the sort of international different states and nations do and the international sort of global bodies?
Well, they must realize that the conflict in South Sudan is primarily a contest over the spoils of state, because there are no institutions that hold the political elite accountable. So corruption is at the root cause of conflict in South Sudan. In order to prevent another conflict in South Sudan, the international community must support efforts to hold the leaders of South Sudan accountable. And that is, facilitating punitive actions like, targeted sanctions at individuals, enacting efforts to trace and seize illicit assets that are stored in these countries, and basically support the presence of strong and viable institutions of governance in South Sudan, and empower civil society to be active in the fight against corruption.
A cynical view might suggest that international actors would have little motivation to do such, because maybe perhaps dirt would be turned up on their governments and their corporations.
Yes, that is true, and it requires political courage to look beyond this. To say that we have a responsibility as humanity to prevent the kind of mass atrocities that have happened in Sudan, in South Sudan and elsewhere, and so reach out and ensure that help is rendered when possible.
Now, Brian, before we let you go, South Sudan is obviously a very young nation. It has a lot of developing to do. What effect is this corruption having on your average citizen?
Well, the standard of living has deteriorated considerably. Right now, as we speak, because of this corruption, the corruption, of course, precipitated conflict, and the conflict itself damaged the economy. And right now, as we speak, the inflation rate is the highest of any place on earth today. It's 295%. And the IMF projects that throughout this year, it may reach 300%. So that's the cost of living has become three times more difficult for South Sudanese individuals. This corruption has ensured that there's no delivery of services at all. You know, in South Sudan, a country the length and breadth of France, there's only less than 1,000 kilometers of tarmac road. And Juba itself is the only city in South Sudan that has paved roads. There's no delivery in health services. Right now, to be a woman in South Sudan, a pregnant woman, is the most dangerous aspect that can happen to anybody. There's no electricity. Prices of basic goods in the market have skyrocketed. There's no fuel. There are long lineups. I was in Juba in April. There are long lineups for fuel. And this is an oil-producing country. So the situation is really dire, and something needs to be done at the moment to pull South Sudan out of the morass that it is right now. And it is incumbent upon the political structure that is in existence at the moment to take the courage required to reform institutions, ensure accountability and empower people, to look out for corrupt practices and report them, and basically try to perhaps steer South Sudan on the correct path that it should have taken before this corruption just ran out of control.
Absolutely. Brian, can't put any better than that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, perfect. If you're just tuning in, that's Brian Adeba from what's called the Enough Project. And that's really just a project to recover, especially South Sudan's stolen public funding that's been taken offshore. And I really hope that could start a sort of a wave or a trend across the continent of saying, wait a second, we've had these previous sort of presidents and military dictators, and a lot of our public funding has been stolen and taken offshore. What happens now? Next, we're just going to switch gears and talk about something that actually happened yesterday, which is World Refugee Day. So 20th June is sort of Global World Refugee Day. And it's a day where we sort of take a second and say, wait a second, we have more than 60 million people around the world who are displaced for various reasons. And that's a sort of ridiculously sort of unfathomable figure when I think of 60 million people. So it's sort of shedding a spotlight on them and saying sort of what's going on. The most marginalized people in the world, really, and saying, why is this happening and what can we do about it? We're going to zoom in on Doctors Without Borders, MSF, and they recently released a communication where they were going to reject funding from EU member states because of what they term as the EU's shameful migrant policy. So we want to zoom in on the sort of European migrant situation, and for this we'll be talking to Jens Pedersen, the humanitarian advisor. Jens, can you hear us? Sorry, we'll just work to get him back on the line. We'll just ask our producers to figure out what's going on. So just to zoom in on this, Greg, I know you touched on this briefly, and you actually went to Germany to get details on what European different states are doing about the migrant situation in the wave of sort of northern Eastern African migrants going over and crossing sort of treacherous waters, people as a result of ISIS going towards Europe. And it's just, there seems to be a lot of sort of, there seems to be a change, I'd like to say. So I dare say that at the start there was a bit of a more open approach of saying these are people and they deserve a right to sort of safe landing and a place to be. And that seems to be changing slightly, yeah, as sort of more and more people cross these oceans. There seems to be a feeling of like, wait, this is a bit too much for us now.
And I think that's for two reasons. So initially we saw, I think one of the key things is to note that they're from the EU member states. There were very vastly different responses to the, yeah, to the streams of migrants that were flowing in. And I think you had some states like Germany that did open its borders and made a vow to keep its borders open. Yep. Where I think they had, you know, upwards something like towards a million people coming in, trying to seek asylum. Where other states like Hungary, you know, closed its, were very harsh against migrants. And so there's a very sort of different and disparate take from different member states. And I think one of the key issues is that with these different takes, so with Germany opening its borders and others closing them, and even in, within places like Germany, this issue being very, very controversial, the EU had to find a common response, otherwise it might have divided between itself and led to sort of borders closing and things like that. And then just quickly before we get Jen on the line, the Paris attacks, I think, also shifted some sentiment against refugees and migrants.
Okay. I think we now have Jen on the line. Jens, can you hear us?
Yep.
Okay, there, perfect. So Jens, just as we introduced you, we were just zooming in on the word from MSF that they will be now rejecting funding from EU member states because of what is sort of they're calling a, or you're calling a shameful migrant policy. So I'd love if you give us insight as to your view on the migrant policy and what makes you think that it is shameful, and thus sort of the logic behind the decision to reject the funding of EU member states.
Yeah, thank you very much. As you say, it's indeed very shameful. I think the consequences of this act, the so-called or the famous EU-Turkey deal, is is in practice and inherently an undermining of the right to seek refugee status for migrants, refugees who, due to very violent conflicts in Syria, Afghanistan, with this deal are now being denied the opportunity to seek protection in the European Union. And what this really does going forward is that it creates a precedent where denying people the right to seek asylum when they are fleeing conflict or seeking protection in other countries is inherently and practically being undermined. And that is shameful because, of course, it's very, very concerning what that means for people seeking protection in conflict and war zones going forward.
Ian, can you just tell us a little bit more about this Turkey deal? The EU, I think, sees it as a solution to at least push the problem, which for them are migrants, to its borders and try to retain sort of the integrity within of its borders within the European Union, and sort of allow a common policy from the EU. But clearly there are specific problems. What's some of the key violations that this Turkey deal raises?
Well, what it does in practice is that it ensures that Turkey closes its borders with Greece and thus preventing asylum seekers to reach any of the EU countries by the virtue of providing Turkey with substantial financial compensation. To basically erect a barrier for people to trying to reach Europe via Turkey. Now, of course, the challenge with that is that it could create, of course, such a sort of a domino effect. Other countries are closing their borders closer to the conflict. Essentially, we end up, and we have seen examples of that in the Syrian conflict, of people being trapped in conflict with actually nowhere to go. So that's one thing. Another thing which is very, very worrying is, of course, that humanitarian aid for migrants in general, is part of this deal, which means that basically Turkey is being compensated through aid packages to prevent migrants from leaving Turkey. What that means is that aid, humanitarian aid, is no longer given necessarily to the ones that need it the most or based on a impartial principle. It's basically given to people in order for them to prevent them from leaving Turkey.
Mm-hmm. But Jens, what do you think is the proper solution to this problem? From the member states and the EU side, there's citizens who are very hostile towards migrants and worry whether their states and the EU can actually provide for all these migrants coming in. There's the EU worrying about this issue sort of splitting different countries and perhaps different countries having to re-erect their borders. If the Turkey deal isn't the right solution, what should these states do given EU and these governments' complex challenges that they face?
Indeed, it is very complex. I mean, we are faced with the largest refugee and migration crisis for many, many, many years. And solutions are complex. They will certainly not be simple. Of course, our concern as MSF is that the solution now with the deal, preventing people from seeking protection and asylum in Europe, for example, has so far-reaching and so inhumane consequences that this by no means can be the solution. However, we have seen that very, very little has been done, for example, to tackle the causes of much of this migration, the conflict in Afghanistan, the conflict in Syria, for example. The push factors which are driving people away from their homes. I mean, let's be honest, people are fleeing from, in some cases, either from incredibly violent conflict or terrible conditions in other countries. It's not that people are simply seeking a better life. But these push factors certainly have not been addressed in any sufficient manner.
So
Turkey deal is basically a way of trying to make up for that, compensate for that.
But can the European nations and the EU, what more can they do, do you think, to solve these push factors? For example, if we look at the war in Syria, do you have suggestions as to how they should further try to solve that?
Well, of course, again, the war in Syria is incredibly complex and has produced many, many refugees. 3 million of them in Turkey, which is three times the number, for example, that have reached Europe, all of the EU countries. What we are saying as an assessment and the reason why we are stopping the funding from EU institutions and EU member states is as a protest against this deal, they have chosen to band-aid the migration crisis upwards. Solving the conflict in Syria is, of course, it's not going to be very easy. Our stand is, however, that more needs to be done, and this EU-Turkey deal, as it's called, is by no means acceptable.
Now, I think it's 90% of MSF's finances that come from private donors. I think that's been written. But still, I think it was 56 million euros came from the EU or member states. Was it last year? Could this stance hamper some of MSF's work, which I'd imagine in many cases is vital for saving lives?
Yes, and this is a very, very valid concern. Of course, MSF, we have more than 5.5 million private donors across the globe, and that's by and large thanks to these very generous donors that we can take a stand as this, which is in line with our medical and humanitarian principles. We have, as an organization, in order to respond to emergencies, we always keep a minimal reserve in order to be able to respond to the unforeseen. So no existing programs or project or patients will go untreated because of this decision to no longer accept EU funds from our side. It is the operational budget of MSF globally is more than 1.2 billion. So as much as 56 million euros is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's a fraction of our overall funds for treating patients and ensuring our program.
Now, has there been any indication yet that this bold stance might make a difference for EU policy?
From the European Union side or the member states, no.
No, none yet.
No, none whatsoever.
Okay, Jens, thanks for chatting to us, and we'll be sure to keep sort of following the situation. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. If you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Just about halfway through the show, and we're sort of focusing on refugees. Yesterday was World Refugee Day, and we have more than 60 million people who are displaced from their homes for various situations. So we're sort of just touching on different different regions and trying to figure out what's going on and what's being done to fix it. So we're just chatting to Jens Pedersen, the humanitarian advisor of Doctors Without Borders, MSF, trying to see why they're rejecting funding from EU member states. I mean, something we didn't get to ask him was I'm quite curious about the situation between MSF and some of the sort of the world's sort of global power, so to speak. During the where they sort of open warfare in some areas, we've had some of their hospitals bombed, and that then there was some tension between the White House in America and MSF saying this is not okay. And I think the slogan was even war has rules. And now this situation where between the EU member states and MSF, it's quite sort of interesting to see this continue to play out. Anyway, that's just speculation. That's not from the horse's mouth, so don't tweet that. Next, we're going to focus on what is often sort of termed the largest refugee camp in the world, which is Dadaab in Kenya, northeastern region of Kenya. And we really just want to zoom in there and say, you know, how did this come to be that there's so many displaced people in one place? What is the plight of these people? And of course, some of the politics surrounding it with the situation between Kenya and then Somalia and Kenya and Al-Shabaab and that fight, and trying to see how does this affect the lives of some of these very, very displaced and marginalized people staying in this area. Talking about this, we'll have Bernard Rono, the education officer from RET International. Bernard, can you hear us? So the line is a bit of... So the line is a bit unclear, so we're just going to chat a bit about that. So as we sort of sort that out, just a bit of sort of background on Dadaab, this is sort of in northeastern Kenya, Garissa County, which we'll remember from the school, the university at Garissa, which had this very, very tragic attack. And that's sort of the region we're talking about. Where Kenya borders Somalia and where a lot of people has to be on the forefront of this situation between the Kenyan military and the African Union mission AMISOM and what's going on with Al-Shabaab. So second try, Bernard, can you hear us? Sorry, the line. Hello, Bernard, can you hear us?
Hi, I can hear you.
Okay, fine. Fantastic. So just giving some context on Dadaab, which often makes headlines as being the world's largest refugee camp or collection of camps. And I'd love for you to just give us a context of what it's like on the ground. I mean, that's hundreds of thousands of people. That's the size of a city. So it's not, I feel like the word sort of refugee camp doesn't do it justice. Could you give us an idea of what it's actually like there on the ground?
I didn't, do you actually, say that again? I didn't get, that question you got.
Okay. So just to repeat, no problem at all. So I'm just saying that the sort of the size of and the scale of Dadaab with hundreds of thousands of people there, that sounds a lot closer to a city than a camp. So I feel like the word camp doesn't do it justice. If you could just give us sort of what it's like living there and being there on the ground every day.
Okay, yes. Dadaab refugee camp is a complex, really. It's about five refugee camps, being Dagahane refugee camp, E41 refugee camp, E42 refugee camp, Hagadera refugee camp, and Kambios. All these refugee camps add up to, roughly about 350,000 people across, mostly for Somali refugees. And then we've got a few from the Democratic Republic of Congo. We've got a few Burundians. We've got some of them from South Sudan, Ethiopia, all cut across. But roughly about 350,000 people in these five different countries.
Absolutely. And your work is largely centered on education. Could you give us an idea of some of the sort of the needs that a lot of these refugees need by the time they're getting to these what you say is a collection of five camps? What kind of needs do they need in terms of education, in terms of healthcare? What are sort of the key concerns that are needed for these camps?
What kind of relief? Sorry,
the line's a bit tough. I was asking if you could just give us an idea of the kind of education needs that you're facing. Your work is centered on educating the displaced people, refugees that arrive there. What are the education needs that you're finding are most needed?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, good question. Yes. I work for an agency organization headquartered in Geneva. It's called REC International. REC International started in the year 2000. It mainly focuses on education, but we also do lively capacity building. This is mainly for the youth. We offer an education like no other for basically for children who are beyond the primary school. So really, when refugees come to the camp, they've got lots of education needs. Those as well who are born here, they are looking at, of course, going for basic education in the primary school, secondary schools as well, and then on to tertiary level. All these education systems are anchored mostly in the Kenyan system of education, the primary school and the secondary school. In the tertiary education, we've got a few agencies that offer tuition and scholarship to either Canadian colleges, American colleges. Some students will do those courses here, either in diploma or degree level. But the need for education is as high as ever. Young people have realized that education is an important tool. Of course, I do believe it's an important tool for protection. The REC International looks at education, as a whole, in a way to get the youth out of any other into society. We take them through school. We deal with youth who are the dropout of school initially, and they come up with a program that takes care of those who either, some of them are working, some of them are mothers, but have missed out on an opportunity to join secondary school and now get a chance to go to school now. That really gets them away from early marriages, sexual and gender-based violence, radicalization issues. But all this is well taken care of by education. And education, I think refugees have realized that it is what will remain when everything else is gone. And we find that many parents, many guardians are very keen that their children go to school. The slightly older ones as well are joining up. We have some agencies that are offering some sort of education for gentlemen, for some guys who are slightly older. So all these basically shows that people believe that if you go to school, then you are protecting yourself, but also preparing yourself for the future.
And I hear you, and it's so incredible to hear people sort of still applying themselves in terms of education and trying to sort of improve their life despite being so disadvantaged in their background. So my final question on this is more on the politics side, and I know you're an educator, not a politician, but the Kenyan government has been heard to threaten that they would move to be closing down the camps and saying they're not getting enough support to keep them open, and saying that the camps are putting them at a disadvantage in terms of the fight against Al-Shabaab. What is your reaction, and based on your work there, when you hear these threats and these comments about we're just going to close this down, what is your response to that?
I think I think what I say is that, of course, we are preparing our beneficiaries, our learners. We are preparing, our beneficiaries who are in the livelihood sector, who are being trained in different skills. We are preparing our beneficiaries in social change, in skills that are sustainable skills for them to either be, if they are in the dab or they are not in the dab, they should be able to survive this. They should be able to get along. We are giving them certificates that will increase their employability. We are giving them skills like tailoring. We're giving them skills in farming that will help them wherever they go. Of course, the issue of closure is beyond us, is beyond myself. We are just here to serve them. We're really keen to serve the refugees wherever they may be. And we are just following development, as it were, in the media, and as we are being informed as time goes on.
Perfect. Thank you so much, and then please keep up the great work.
Thank you, too. Thank you very much as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you. If you're just tuning in, that was us speaking to Bernard Rono, our education officer that works with RET International, based in Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, northeastern Kenya, on the border of Somalia. You're hearing from that just a reluctance to really comment on what the government's up to. And I suppose it makes sense for a lot of the people working there and saying, hey, it's out of our hands. But I still think there's value in saying, in being on the ground and saying, you know what, I work with these people every day and I can speak for them and say, listen, this is not sort of a terrorism breeding ground. They're like, they're good and innocent people here who are just, trying to protect themselves and their families.
Kingsley, I'm quite interested in your viewpoints. Obviously, being from Kenya and having a lot of friends and family that you're in touch with, is what you're hearing is that closing this thing is a great idea? Because I'd imagine you're from Nairobi and people are worried about terrorist attacks, they're worried about radicalization, or are Kenyans fairly split over this issue?
So I, just to start on the sort of on the government side, I get the sense that it's more of a pawn in the government's game to get additional sort of international funding, and I think the threat to close the Dadaab is more of a threat than something the government actually intends on. I know that wasn't your question, but just quickly on the government side, I hear it much more as a threat of saying we will close this down, and the aim is to get more support in the fight against Al-Shabaab and get more support in holding refugees there. Remember, there's hundreds of thousands of people. Even actually closing it, that's like closing down a city. So I don't feel a genuine intention from the government to close it down anytime in the near term. I think it's a pawn in saying, hey, this fight against, and this I somewhat agree with, this fight against Al-Shabaab is not only a Kenyan thing. America has a lot of influence in East Africa and has been a big part to play in this. Other Western powers are part of this. But suddenly when we talk about refugees and Al-Shabaab, it becomes a Kenyan problem and saying, hey, you've been a part of creating this. You have stake in this. You have skin in this game. You can't say the Al-Shabaab issue and the refugee issue is a Kenyan problem. You have to come to the party and say, hey, we want sort of a decent, haven for people who are fleeing from the conflict. Come to the party, let's do this together. Is it fair to use it as a threat? I suppose not, but it's politics.
Is that how the Kenyan public's viewing it, though, or are people more divided?
I'd agree on the division. I get a sense that on one hand, there's a genuine sympathy of saying, why are innocent people the ones suffering from this? And on the other hand, it's saying, listen, Somalis and Kenyan Somalis are killing us and they have to get out of the country. And it's sort of that split. Okay. Now to switch to something local, when we often talk about refugees in South Africa, we often see it as a very distant, a very foreign thing, and we thought it was also just important to bring it home. And to talk about this, we'll be talking about we'll be talking to Amnesty International's executive director, Sinqelimpilo Shange Butani. Sinqelimpilo, can you hear us? This is not a great day for us on the phone. We'll just chat to our producer to fix that. So, Greg, we were talking a bit about how we see refugees as such a foreign thing. But at the same time, we have this other word that we use a lot. We talk about xenophobia. We talk about attacks on migrants locally. And it often seems, and even recently with this issue in Tswane that's happening, I was hearing reports of foreign shop owners being targeted. So it seems to be something that comes up. Whenever there's some kind of looting, some kind of violence, there's always word that foreigners are being targeted, and it's clearly an issue in communities.
Well, it's undeniable, but South Africa has a lot of pull factors. If we go back to one of the conversations we were talking about earlier, a lot of pull factors for migrants who want to come here because of the economic opportunities, because of the sort of higher level of development, because of the greater infrastructure. And so you do get some of these sort of conflicts in local areas that manifest themselves in violence when communities have their issues.
Okay. Sinqelimpilo, can you hear us?
Hello.
Okay, perfect. Sorry, we lost you there for a bit. So, Sinqelimpilo, we want to talk a bit about Amnesty International's stance on the issue of refugees in South Africa, and especially the communication that says that authorities must do more to increase the protection of refugees and asylum seekers in the country. I'd like to hear from you. What do you think is the role of the state, of police, and of South African authorities in protecting refugees and asylum seekers in the country?
Okay, thank you so much for the opportunity.
No problem.
Yes, so as Amnesty International, really we are calling for increased protection for refugees and asylum seekers in the country in particular. And when we are talking about this, we are saying, yes, we acknowledge and appreciate that the South African government, for instance, has adopted a local integration as a way of accepting refugees into the country so we don't keep them in camps. At the same time, we are saying that at the moment, we do have areas where the government, for instance, is lagging a bit behind. So, for instance, in terms of ensuring that they have access to services, all the services that refugees are supposed to be having access to, for instance, issues including access to education, also being able to seek employment in the country. One of the other main worrying issue is around the safety and security of refugees in South Africa, especially with the xenophobic attacks that are directed at them. In that regard, we're saying government needs to be doing more in terms of strengthening some of the mechanisms in our communities and in the justice system to ensure that really refugees feel safe and protected in South Africa.
I'd love if you could just speak more on that. What do you think are some of these mechanisms that you mentioned? What are they? What are the ways government can actually do something about that? Because I think often the defense, or not the defense, but the explanation from government is saying, this is a symptom of a country that's losing jobs. It's a symptom of a country that's already struggling with service provision. And they're saying that's what happens when we're already struggling to provide basic services and employment. And we have people from other countries coming in. Local communities are going to target those people the second they feel the pinch, whether it's load shedding, whether it's unemployment. So the government is almost saying it's not our fault. We're trying. And when you add more people, it gets worse. So what do you think of that response from government? And then secondly, what do you think they actually can do to fight against what we see often when there's xenophobic attacks?
Okay, so thanks again. So for instance, when we do acknowledge as Amnesty that the country is facing the challenge of the triple burden of unemployment, inequality and poverty. And what we are saying is that government, can invest more in terms of some of the social services to address some of those challenges and create employment opportunities. However, at the same time, we're saying that cannot be used as a scapegoat to say that we are not able to provide for our citizens and therefore we can't provide for refugees or people to be allowed to attack refugees because they are saying that they do not have jobs, they do not have access to food or any other opportunities. I think one of the things that needs to happen is really for people to understand what their rights are and how to claim them from the government and therefore not have what I can call maybe displaced anger against refugees and migrants. In terms of our own constitution and also the Refugees Act, refugees also have the right, for instance, to access social services in this country. Part of the challenge and what government needs to be doing is, when they do the planning, for instance, the IDPs, integrated development plans for municipalities, they do not involve all the members of those communities. So this issue around saying that refugees are coming in and taking jobs or not taking services that are supposed to be received by South Africans, that's where the first problem starts. For instance, when government is doing planning on local municipality planning, they need to involve every person who lives within those localities, because in so doing, they will then be able to cater for the exact numbers that are there that need the particular services. When it comes to issues of xenophobia, for instance, one of the things that we are really calling for is a national-led strategy, for instance, on addressing, so firstly, the protection of everyone within communities. And part of this protection mechanism would include early warning systems, for instance. You know, something almost similar to what used to happen where you had committees who knew, for instance, if there's a pending attacks or something like that, then they'll be able to alert authorities at that very moment. Or what can happen, for instance, is also to create maybe like hotlines where people can report if there is a pending attack in the community. And one of the trends that we have noticed is around service delivery protests, where, for instance, when we have community members protesting around service delivery, failure of service delivery, they then attack refugees within their communities. So oftentimes, community members know when there is a plan to attack refugees. So what we are saying is that government should build then and capitalize on those mechanisms that are already in the communities to ensure that those are used constructively to feed into government response mechanisms.
And we have heard talk from the government side about early warning mechanisms, but I'm not sure what's been going on with that. One question I just want to quickly get to before we're going to have to let you go is there's legislation on the table at the moment, the Refugees Amendment Bill, which could, if passed, would reduce the time afforded to asylum seekers to approach their nearest refugee reception office once they come in South Africa from 10 down to 5 days. What sort of effect will this have on refugees trying to seek asylum in the country?
Okay, thank you. So firstly, one of the challenges is that currently some of the refugee reception offices, the number of refugee reception offices in the country has been reduced. Therefore, newly arriving asylum seekers have less options now of offices to go to apply for asylum. So actually in reducing the number now of days for people to be able to reach the nearest refugee reception office, we are opening them up, for instance, to being arrested or other rights violations, because it will take them longer to reach the nearest refugee reception office. So, for instance, let's say someone who did not come through the Musina border, where there is a refugee next to the border, but who came through other points of entry, and they are, let's say, where have they closed an office in Cape Town, for instance. Those people are expected to go to Johannesburg, where there is an office, to apply for asylum. So where do they get them in? Because they do need to legalize their stay in the country. So that opens them up to a lot of rights violations. But also access to services, as we are just talking about it now, in terms of communities in border areas, how are those going to be resourced to ensure that for some of the people, for instance, who may not be able to travel quickly, are able to be provided in terms of the services that they need. But one other thing that I wanted to address quickly around the issue of protection that we're talking about is around strengthening the justice system, because one of the things that keeps coming up around the attacks is that communities sometimes require refugees to negotiate in order for them to be returned back to the communities. They ask them to drop the cases. So we're saying that needs to be strengthened, because you cannot violate someone's rights and expect that you will negotiate and say if you drop a case, therefore you can come back to the community. That should never be allowed.
Nipilo, thank you so much. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, and I'm sure we'll make time to go much deeper on this in the future. Thank you.
Okay, no, thank you so much.
Okay, perfect. Something that we didn't really touch on that is just about immigration policy. And I remember during Operation Fiela Reclaim in the city, there was a lot of reporting, and Greg, you reported on this idea of illegal and forced deportations and a lot of things that were happening sort of under the radar by the police and the army. And that's I don't think a conversation that's being had when we talk about the rights of sort of asylum seekers in the country.
I know for I'm not sure about asylum seekers, but different migrants, particularly from sort of neighboring countries, many of them say they have issues with the police in terms of, you know, having their passport demanded on the spot.
And if
they don't have their passport there, they might be arrested and not afforded the chance to produce their documents. And I think there's a number of issues dealing with sort of the authorities that different migrants face, and that I'm not sure if the authorities are willing to try to work out.
Absolutely. I mean, my view is, has always been that a government's looking at its sort of employment plan and unemployment's, I mean, unemployment's increasing, you know, there's no job, service delivery is struggling, and they look at foreigners and they're like, we just don't have space, we don't have room. So you use any mechanism you can, whether that's the immigration policy, whether that's the police, whether that's the army, and it appears to me that there's a sort of very well thought out and systematic plan to make it very difficult for people coming to South Africa either to seek asylum or otherwise, to either keep them out, and if they're here, make it very difficult for them while they're here.
I think in the government's defense for a second, I think that they would strenuously deny any sort of plot against this, but at the same time note that they do have quite humane refugee laws compared to many other countries out there. But it does seem that there is definitely an effort to make the system of migration much more official and formal rather than informal and ungovernable.
We have to go again and kicked out of the studio. We love you very much, and we'll see you next week.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.